This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 6, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Activists are questioning the ethics of pharmaceutical lobbies on Capitol Hill. Tony Blair is elected to a historic third term, although it's quite far from a popular mandate. And we'll take a look at municipal elections held in the West Bank and Gaza. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The chair of the Oil for Food Inquiry Committee, Paul Volcker, said that U.S. congressmen misused their subpoena power when they demanded that a former investigator turn over documents. A lawyer who resigned from the committee investigation team turned over the documents after receiving the subpoena, saying they show the committee's report protects U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan. Volcker stated today that the subpoena issued to Robert Parton was inappropriate and that the investigator was not obligated to turn over the papers because he has immunity.
Confidential committee files have been released to congressional committees contrary to express confidentiality agreements and affirmations made as recently as a month ago that no such documents were held outside the committee.
The Oil for Food program was established by the United Nations so that Saddam Hussein's regime could purchase food and other humanitarian items while still under international embargo. An inquiry committee led by the former U.S. Federal Reserve chair is investigating allegations of corruption. African American ministers are trying to curb the sway of the religious right and criticized the Senate Majority Leader for calling those who disagree with him non-believers. David Kopel reports from D.C.
Today, the African American Ministers in Action declared their support for the use of the filibuster in the Senate to block some of President Bush's judicial nominees. AAMIA Chairman Reverend Timothy McDonald specifically outlined their objections to two nominees, Priscilla Owen and Janice Rogers Brown. These judges, he said, are considered far out of the mainstream and a danger to the civil rights movement. Congressman Elijah Cummings of Maryland deplored Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist's participation in an event last week that chastised those supporting the filibuster were against people of faith.
As a person of faith myself, the son of two preachers, I am deeply disappointed that Senate Majority Leader Frist has tried to recruit people of the religious community to attack Democrats who are standing up for the American values. I believe it is wrong. It is wrong to challenge a person's religious faith in the context of a political debate.
The ministers focus on ways to ensure that the views of the African American religious community are equally represented on the issue. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm David Koppel.
The South African government will consider creating laws against free speech after news reports of a leak at a nuclear plant. Naeem Jinnah reports from Johannesburg.
Media organizations in South Africa have slammed government threats to act against journalists who, it believes, have made what President Thabo Mbeki has called reckless statements. The uproar began after comments by Minister of Mineral and Energy, Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka. She responded in anger to reports about unacceptably high radiation levels at South Africa's Pelindaba nuclear facility. The reports followed an investigation by environmental group EarthLife Africa. Soon after the minister's comment, Mbeki weighed in on the debate, dismissing the reports as reckless. An occupational health expert has found in the meanwhile that a number of Pelindaba workers have been exposed to hazardous substances. The Media Institute of Southern Africa, the Freedom of Expression Institute, a number of academics and opposition politicians have slammed the government comments, particularly Mlambo Ngcuka's threat that new laws will be passed to prevent such whistleblowing. Here, threats to media freedom immediately evoke the image of South Africa's neighbor, Zimbabwe, where media freedom is all but dead. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Naeem Jinnah in Johannesburg.
Mexico's two right-wing parties are still struggling over the now-closed case against the leading presidential candidate. Shannon Young reports from Oaxaca.
Top politicians within the PRI, the party that ruled Mexico for over seven decades, are calling the decision to drop charges against Andrés Manuel López Obrador immoral. This week, the new attorney general announced that, although his office believes that López Obrador violated the law, the contempt of court and abuse of authority charges would not be prosecuted in the interest of national stability. PRI politicians are saying that the case is now an issue for the judicial branch and have indicated that contempt of court charges may be filed against the new attorney general. López Obrador is scheduled to meet with President Fox this afternoon in what is interpreted as a move to close the book on the case that has occupied the national spotlight for over a year. Since Mexican law prohibits politicians campaigning for the presidency from holding office, López Obrador is expected to step down from his mayoral position on Monday to dedicate himself to his presidential campaign. For FSRN, this is Shannon Young in Oaxaca.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Preliminary results reveal that the Fatah movement has won municipal elections held in 84 cities across the West Bank and Gaza in Palestine yesterday. Official results are expected this Sunday after all votes are counted. Few troubles were reported at polling booths, although a group of mass people destroyed 2 out of 3 ballot boxes in Attara, north of Ramallah. FSRN's Manir Jabrin had the opportunity to speak with Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative, or Mubadara, about the election.
What do you think of the local governmental elections that took place yesterday, and what does it mean for the Palestinian people?
These elections were very important. They are an additional step in the direction of full democratization and regardless, I mean, with the exception of one place in Attara where some Fatah activists took the boxes and burned them, the elections went smoothly and democratically in every place. And that, in my opinion, this is a big success and the biggest victory is for the Palestinian people. This is one aspect. The second aspect, it was clear during the elections that people want change, and that's why they voted dramatically for change. The third issue is that it is obvious that there are 3 major forces in Palestine now. There is Fatah, Hamas, and the third democratic strand represented by Al-Mubadara and PFLP in some places.
Al-Mubadara, as you mentioned, what coalition does it represent?
It represents the Palestinian National Initiative, which is a new Palestinian political social movement that was established 2.5 years by Dr. Abdel Shafi, myself, and Edward Said, late Edward Said. And it includes now it has presence in the thousands of activists across the country, but it also tries to create good coalitions with lots of independents. So in a way, I think it is right to call it sometimes the party of independence. And it is trying to reflect the opinion of the majorities, the silent majority, about 40% who don't belong neither to Fatah nor Hamas. And if they sometimes find a good alternative, they would vote for it. So this is a promising movement that has a social and political program. And in the presidential elections, we managed to gather almost 30% of the votes. And we think this is going to be a good base for the upcoming Legislative Council elections.
Dr. Mustafa, does the initial outcome of the elections mean that Fatah guaranteed in advance the PLC elections next July?
No. It actually, Fatah should revise its programs because it has lost many places it used to control. Fatah was in charge of 100% of the municipalities where we had elections. Now they don't control more than maybe 50% or 45%.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Mustafa.
Thank you.
Tony Blair's Labour Party was re-elected to government for a historic third term in Britain. However, it's very far from a popular mandate. The war in Iraq and other controversial issues slashed Labour's lead down to a 66-seat majority in Parliament. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Despite Labour Party attempts to play it down, there's no doubt now that the war in Iraq played a deciding factor in the outcome of this election. One notable shock result was the dramatic unseating of Labour's pro-war Una King by George Galloway of newly formed anti-war party
George
Respect.
George Galloway is duly elected a Member of Parliament.
Mr. Blair, this is for Iraq. This defeat that you have suffered and all the other defeats that New Labour has suffered this evening is for Iraq. All the people you killed, all the lies you told, have come back to haunt you.
Tony Blair fought off a challenge in his constituency from Reginald Keyes, father of a British soldier killed in Iraq. Candidates
in all. It seems as if it's clear, but also that the British people wanted the return of a Labour government, but with a reduced majority. And we have to respond to that sensibly and wisely and responsibly. And I know, too, that Iraq has been a divisive issue in this country. But I hope now that we can unite again and look to the future, there and here.
But the wise response he has in mind may differ from that of his party. Some members of his own party have called him a liability in this campaign. His position is in question as he forms the third Labour government. It was the best result for the anti-war Liberal Democrats since 1929. Disillusioned Labour Party voters and those against the Iraq War switched in significant numbers to the third opposition party, making British politics more of a three-horse race. Liberal Democrat leader Charles Kennedy.
Overall, this general election has clearly resulted in a new House of Commons, which I think will be much healthier in a party political sense than what the last 8 years have been. That the government cannot ride roughshod over people's instincts, people's inspiration, people's views. I think that there are very serious questions, however, for parliamentary democracy, that victory can be gained on such a low level of support.
As for the pro-war Conservative Party, who fought the campaign on a platform of further restrictions on immigration, although they won some seats back from Labour, their share of the overall vote has remained unchanged for them since the last election. Conservative Party leader Michael Howard.
I've said many times since I became leader and during this election campaign that accountability matters. I've said that if people don't deliver, they go. And for me, delivering meant winning the election. I didn't do that. I didn't do that despite my best efforts. And I want to do now what is best for my party and above all for my country. I shall resign as leader.
So with one resignation and questions over Tony Blair's continued leadership, this is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
As controversy continues over the pharmaceutical industry misrepresenting the safety of their drugs, mental health advocates launched a nationwide campaign this week against the powerful pharmaceutical lobby known as Pharma. They accuse Pharma of using aggressive promotional techniques to sell psychiatric drugs that activists claim are better for the drug company's bottom line than for the people consuming them. They're calling on Pharma to stop such practices and to stop funding so-called front groups that are promoting policies of forced medication on people with mental illnesses. Pharma, meanwhile, has refused to meet with the activist. Mitch Jezrich has more from Washington.
Stop forced mental health treatment. Stop forced mental health treatment.
Demonstrators gathered outside the Washington, D.C. office of the pharmaceutical lobby and trade organization Pharma to launch a new campaign claiming that the industry has taken over the country's healthcare system and that it financially supports organizations that advocate for broader authorities to involuntarily treat people with psychiatric disabilities. Krista Erickson came from Chicago for the protest.
Well, there's a number of things wrong with forced treatment. To start with, it's a tremendous act of violence against people. It's a horrendous human rights violation against people. Oftentimes, when people are subjected to forced treatment, they're not told. They're being subjected to forced treatment with very powerful drugs, such as neuroleptics, that cause an immense amount of damage, such as permanent brain damage and other physical symptoms.
Erickson is part of a coalition known as Mind Freedom. The group accuses Pharma of aggressively promoting psychiatric drugs for mental illness, so to boost the profits for pharmaceutical companies. Pharma's influence in Washington goes deep, says Jim Gottstein, with the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights.
The pharmaceutical industry spent, I think, about $150 million last year. It was the largest industry in lobbying, and there are 40 members of Congress that have left Congress to work for the pharmaceutical industry. In fact, the new director of Pharma, which is the organization here, left Congress after passing this Medicare bill.
with all due respect to the demonstrators, we do believe they have it wrong.
Jeff Truitt is a spokesperson for pharma. He says psychiatric drugs are only meant to help people live productive lives.
We oppose forced treatment. It should be a matter of doctors and patients working together to decide which is the best tool to use or tools to use.
Pharma, as we've heard, has an army, 88,000 strong, who are on the front lines with doctors trying to convince them to write prescriptions for their product.
Dr. Michael Wilkes, Vice Dean of Medicine at UC Davis, testified on Thursday to the House Government Reform Committee on the relationship between pharmaceutical companies and doctors.
Somebody who comes in with a free lunch or a gift or an invitation to a sporting event and asks them and tells them that this is a better drug than what they're using is a far more powerful message. It should be the other way around. We should read the New England Journal. We should be able to cite that data. But practicing doctors just aren't there.
They're relying a lot on what the drug reps
have enormously.
To say at the same hearing, Dennis Erb, a representative for the pharmaceutical company Merck, acknowledged that the drug company required its field representatives not to answer doctors' questions about the harmful effects of the drug Vioxx. He said the company requires doctors to fill out paperwork so to get the needed information.
If it's an unsolicited question from the physician, that they can send in what we call professional information requests, and information will be sent to the physician based on that question.
Meanwhile, pharma has yet to respond to numerous requests by the demonstrators for a meeting. Mitch Cheserich, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
The Bush administration has repealed the 2001 Roadless Area Conservation Rule, one of the most popular environmental protections passed in recent years. Once federally protected for wildlife, clean drinking water, and recreation, more than 58 million acres of national forests are now vulnerable to mining, logging, and oil drilling. Ingrid Drake from the D.C. Radio Co-op has more.
You're likely going to hear from a lot of agitated people. They will say that the forests will be destroyed.
Yesterday, Undersecretary of Agriculture Mark Wray announced the repeal of the Roadless Area Conservation Rule. The repeal occurs despite more than 1.7 million people asking the U.S. Forest Service not to make such changes last year. One of the critics is Robert Vandermark with the Heritage Forest Campaign, a coalition of more than 30 environmental groups.
So what was protected yesterday is now today being put on the endangered species list. These lands now receive no federal protection and can be open to commodity development from the logging, mining, and oil and gas industries.
Vandermark says the rule protects clean drinking water for more than 60 million people, as well as preserves natural habitats for wildlife and public recreation.
This law was put in place after years and years of careful deliberation from the American public, from a committee of scientists. Past administration went through tons and tons of review, had over 600 public hearings, received over 2.5 million comments from Americans around the country asking to save these last precious areas.
The new rules will put decision-making power in the hands of state governors and political appointees at the Department of Agriculture. Undersecretary Wray, a former lobbyist for the timber industry, says the new rules will have little impact upon the natural environment.
There isn't a large number of Forest Service engineers sitting at drafting desks today wearing out number two pencils with road design projects.
Tony Yonardo from the National Environmental Trust disagrees.
It's entirely disingenuous to say that there's no immediate threat. As soon as this policy is in effect, which is essentially today, 35 million acres of national forests are open to logging. Period.
While the governors of New Mexico and California have pledged no new development in roadless areas, the Bush administration's rule changes do not ensure public comments will be implemented. Conservation groups are currently discussing whether to participate in the statewide rulemaking and potential legal challenges to the new rules. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake with the D.C. Radio Co-op.
A series of immigration overhaul provisions came one step closer to becoming law when the House of Representatives passed immigration reform amendments as part of the $82 billion war supplemental last night. Included in the bill are strict driver's license standards, a national license database, and money to construct a fence along the Mexico-California border. Yet another feature of the bill takes away the right of habeas corpus to any immigrant facing deportation. In New York, FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Maribel Prado's job is to perform financial background checks on potential homebuyers. She was born in Colombia and moved to the United States with her parents and with a green card when she was six, nearly 30 years ago. But 4 years ago, her journey towards deportation began. She was convicted of check fraud and sentenced to 1 year in prison.
But as time went on, instead of
being released on parole to my house, I was released to immigration. So after I did a year, I was transferred to Pike County, Pennsylvania, and I did 3 months.
As an immigrant with a green card, her felony conviction could result in deportation. But Maribel insisted that she became a citizen with her mother in 1986. But records show that Maribel was only a green card holder. Immigration Court and the Board of Immigration Appeals and the Court of Appeals all concluded that Maribel should be deported.
I mean, I could have signed my deportation, but I didn't, I couldn't, you know, my daughter here, my family, my boyfriend, I just couldn't sign it and just go and, you know, I couldn't do that. So I had to fight my case. It was really hard. It was the worst time of my life, I think.
So Maribel had one more chance to prove her citizenship. She issued a petition of habeas corpus to question the legality of her case. The federal district judge decided that Maribel should not be deported because there were errors in her paperwork. He ruled that she became a citizen in 1986, the same time as her mother.
So just because of that habeas petition, then that's what saved me.
In the Real ID Act that passed the House of Representatives last night, the right to habeas corpus is eliminated for immigrants facing deportation. This is often the last step in legal proceedings to question the legality of deportation. Benita Jane is a legal staffer for the Immigrant Defense Project in New York City. She says that habeas corpus is a crucial step for immigrants facing deportation.
On a legal level, it's going to allow the government to unlawfully deport many immigrants, because many immigrants will, on a practical level, not be able to challenge unlawful deportation orders.
It could affect both legal and undocumented immigrants who are convicted of a crime, immigrants detained as suspected terrorists, or, as in Maribel's case, immigrants with errors in their paperwork or court proceedings. Instead of habeas corpus, the Real ID Act allows immigrants to appeal their deportation case with a petition for review to the Federal Court of Appeals. Deputy Assistant Attorney General Jonathan Cohn pushed for the position in a Senate subcommittee hearing in April. He justified the constitutionality of the law when he said, quote, "No alien, not even criminal aliens, will be deprived of judicial review of such claims. The bill would give every alien one day in the Court of Appeals." Jeff Lundgren, spokesperson for the Judiciary Committee, said in a phone interview that the purpose of the provision is to speed up the deportation proceedings of criminal immigrants. But Benita Jen of the Immigrant Defense Fund said the writ of habeas corpus is a safety net for immigrants in which the government was misapplying the law.
You know, in terms of immigration, people are detained. There's no right to a government attorney if you can't afford somebody. There's very little resources in prison, so it's almost impossible for people to do things there, to file legal papers quickly. On top of that, a lot of people just don't know that they've been ordered deported until it's way too late for people to file the petition for review.
The Senate will likely vote on the Real ID Act next week. For Free Speech Radio News in New York, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
In Colombia, nearly 3 weeks of sustained combat between the country's largest rebel group and the army has tested the resistance of the indigenous Nasa people caught in the crossfire. The fighting thus far has killed 3 policemen, 1 9-year-old girl, and a 1-year-old girl. 20 homes, a school, church, and a hospital have also been left in ruin. FSRN's Nicole Carson has more.
On the dawn of April 14th, FARC fighters laid siege on the town of Turibio, a center of indigenous Nasa resistance, where President Álvaro Uribe had stationed heavily armed police bunkers annexed to civilian homes. The rebel attack was directed against Uribe's U.S.-funded democratic security strategy to win back territory controlled by illegally armed groups. An 8-year-old boy displaced from Turibio recounts what happened that morning. "We were in Turibio displaced by the guerrilla," he says. "First, they convinced us to leave the town so the guerrilla could stay with the police. You should have seen the quantity of guerrillas that took over the school, ruining the fences to arm their gas cylinder bombs." The continued fighting in Turibio and other villages serves as yet another example of how Colombia's 41-year-old conflict pits an autonomous indigenous struggle for resistance in the crossfire. Ezequiel Bitonas, coordinator of the indigenous governments of Northern Cauca.
De hecho, hicimos oficios Before the attack, we requested that the government remove the police bunkers from the village. It's not our problem to resolve the conflict with the guerrilla. We're busy organizing our communities and our lives, and that's why we don't side with the armed actions of the government or the insurgency, because the government has killed our people, and so has the guerrilla.
In Toribio alone, FARC rebels have killed 6 indigenous NASA in the past year, and right-wing paramilitaries killed 5 NASA leaders since January. After years of killings and attempts by armed groups to control their territory and culture, the NASA implemented their own 7,000-strong nonviolent indigenous guard. Last September, armed only with traditional batons, some 400 NASA combed the jungle on foot for 36 hours to rescue their mayor and ex-governor, kidnapped by the FARC 2 weeks prior. This massive search conducted by civilians forced the FARC to return the indigenous leaders unharmed and earned the indigenous guard the National Peace Prize. The Colombian government, however, discourages the indigenous guards, saying that they should join the armed forces. As fighting continued throughout the region, members of the indigenous guard were assigned to accompany journalists entering the combat zone. 18-year-old Jesus Leonidas.
I joined the indigenous guard because I like it. There are many youth today that joined the war and the different armed groups. But from our point of view, as indigenous people, we said no to the war, no to the armed groups, and we won't join them. We've had to defend our own autonomy by carrying the baton, which signifies our authority and the strength to continue struggling as indigenous people here.
Throughout the Andean foothills, homemade white flags demark NASA refugee shelters called permanent assemblies. After a day of close combat near the village, some 500 people gathered in the clinic of Natala. Food and mattresses were scarce, hepatitis A had broken out, and the electricity had just gone out when a village leader announced that the FARC planned on taking over the clinic that evening.
It seems that they want to come here, so the guard and the whole community must be alert. We will not be afraid and we will not leave. No, we will stay here.
The FARC did not take the civilian shelter that evening. On April 30th, NASA leaders met with President Uribe and called for an immediate ceasefire, removal of troops from their territory, and a negotiated solution. Uribe said he would not comply. In a statement to the president, NASA leaders said, quote, "Our position regarding the FARC is the same as our position with the armed forces, and it corresponds to our permanent demand of respect for our process, authorities, territory, and the right not to be involved in the armed conflict." From Toribio, Cauca, I'm Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica stations WBAI in New York, KPFK in Los Angeles, and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jay Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millen, and Eric Klein. Special thanks to Transbay for web services. For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.